now.
In the theme of today's episode, bro. That's like Australian.
Yeah, right? This is bad. This is bad. I'm dropping it. I can't continue.
Hey, no. But if you colonize the majority of the world and genocide millions and billions of people across history, I have a right to make fun of your accent.
That's right. Those French. I mean, British. I mean, Spanish. Portuguese. Oh, right. Who knows?
What a great cold.
But we love it.
I'm very excited about this episode because I will be talking about one of my favorite topics in the world, the man of mystery and legend,
Kanye West.
In so much Kanye West. No, Kanye doesn't get any more space in this podcast for now. But we'll be talking about the works and the politics and the religion of J.R.R. Tolkien. John Ronald Reuel Tolkien.
I was about to ask you what it stood for, so I appreciate you
so
preempting that.
I will say, I mean, for the Tolkien purists, I know my numbers say about 50% of the people that listen to this are Tolkien purists. I say
higher.
Tolkien, I am an American. The true British way to say it would be Tolkien.
Tolkien.
Yeah, and I just feel like, I say Tolkien, it's a problem. It allows you to do more puns when it's Tolkien, because it's like,
you're Tolkien.
What you talking about?
Yeah, all the Tolkien-based puns out there.
Yes, there's so many, honestly. But we're going to be talking about that, and we'll be tying in some recent mass media that has had Tolkien's name attached to it. So
yeah.
Thanks for joining the episode. We're glad to be back. Glad to have you back. And
rock and roll.
Oi, brov.
All right. So as you may have guessed, we're going to jump in right to our mass media segment here. We're going to talk about The Rings of Power. So this is a new show. It's the Amazon Prime show about the second age of the Middle Earth era, set in Tolkien's world. It's I think at this point the most expensive TV show ever produced, and we've got a nice little soundtrack to go along with this. So it stars, I would say the main cast member, that would be Morfydd Clark. She plays Galadriel, a younger Galadriel, a more driven Galadriel. I was really impressed by the series, and Seth is just gonna keep playing. He's got the whole theme song memorized. I'm astounded. I'm gonna let you listen for a second. I'm on Numenor. I'm on a ship heading towards Middle Earth. That was great. I've got a
Wow. Beautiful. Yeah, so I just heard about this show yesterday, and
yeah, and you just you wrote that, right?
Yeah, I just thought I'd write my own score to kind of go with the, you know, the themes of the show. No. Yeah, thanks for covering why I was in the corner.
Yeah, making some beautiful music.
Are we
going to
get copyrighted for that? You know,
I don't think people care about us enough.
Maybe if we don't say anything.
Yeah.
Yes, so McManus Movie Corner, Rings of Power. Thank you for that introduction.
McManus Media Corner. We got to be pedantic.
Oh, yeah, because it is a show. It's not a movie.
Yeah.
But Lord of the Rings are movies, and obviously, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Rings of Power. You probably heard of it. I'm assuming for everyone watching, you haven't seen all, you know, 8 episodes at this point. Maybe you have.
You should. You really should.
Yeah, what are you doing? but yeah, so Rings of Power, it's a very interesting thing. And yeah, it's this whole long saga that I will not go all the way into. But essentially you have Christopher Tolkien was the son of
of J.R.R. Tolkien. The Tolkien that we know of.
Yeah. And he passed away in 2020. And from my knowledge, that sort of opened up new opportunities with the rights of the books that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse. Yeah, the rights became available. And actually, the streaming services all made a bid to create a new show, a new fantasy show. And so you had HBO saying they wanted to remake the movies that Peter Jackson made in the early 2000s with Elijah Wood and all that. So they wanted to do that. Netflix wanted to do an MCU version where they would have a different show for each character. So Gandalf would have a show and Aragorn would have a show and all this stuff, right? And then you had these two nerds, J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay, made the bid. They said, hey,
to my knowledge, not done anything
their
near this level before.
Very
I mean,
empty,
like, they've done a couple TV show episodes, but this was like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they made a bid to Amazon and to the Tolkien estate and said, hey, you know, we want to use the rights from the Second Age of Middle Earth, which is a time several thousand years before the events that happened in Lord of the Rings. And if you don't know anything about Lord of the Rings, just keep tracking. We'll get you there. We'll get you there. But so these two guys just out of nowhere, you know, made this bid, and people seemed to like it, and Amazon put money behind it. And The Rings of Power is the most expensive TV show ever made by double.
Oof.
So Amazon,
was it worth it?
Bezos money came behind this thing, and
could have spent that money on worse things, I guess, but
many worse things, but also better things. But yeah. It is what it is. So they made this show, and so they have a 5-season run plan for this show called The Rings of Power. And this show is actually set 2,000 years before the events that happen in those movies that you may have heard of or seen from the early 2000s.
So understandably, you know, there's not a lot of the, you know, you think of Lord of the Rings and you think of Frodo and maybe Aragorn and Legolas, all of those main characters, right? You know, thousands of years before, we're not going to encounter really any of those, with maybe a couple secret spoiler exceptions.
Yes.
This opens up. And what's fascinating as well, and we haven't even talked about the series yet, the Second Age is pretty sparse in terms of what Tolkien wrote out. He wrote out a lot of legends for the era before that, the thousands of years before. And then you have the books set in the Lord of the Rings era, which is after this. But in between, he only gives us a couple tidbits of what happens. So these writers had a whole lot to work with, right? They had this whole kingdom, right? This whole fantasy kingdom of the race of men, and it's supposed to be the greatest kingdom and grandest kingdom ever. And they had the golden age of the elves as well, which was just, I mean, there's a whole lot that they could do with it.
But also a lot of gaps that they have to fill.
They have
in,
to fill as
or
well,
that they're
right?
Choosing
for it
to
make
to
sense.
Fill in
yeah.
To,
Yeah.
And so that's where sort of this show comes out of is. It's an area of Tolkien's writings that has never been put to screen. And, you know, if you've seen those Lord of the Rings movies, the first 5 minutes kind of give you this overview of there's this bad guy named Sauron. He makes these rings and he like ensnares lots of people to follow him and blah, blah, blah. This show is, I think
like that
the
first
goal
sentence
of this show
yeah.
is basically like showing you that through five seasons of very expensive and pretty looking television. So all that to say, here on Not at the Dinner Table with Patrick and Seth, we talk about politics and religion. So this show has a lot of interesting sort of political things to it, and I think it will continue to over the next and the coming seasons. And to avoid major spoilers, you already mentioned there's a island nation which Tolkien actually designed after the Kingdom of Atlantis.
Yes.
So
yes, the fictional.
This
allegedly fictional.
Yeah, fictional. Who says it's fictional? I've seen Aquaman.
Oh,
it's real.
Oh man.
So you have this. So he's using this theme of Atlantis, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, but Atlantis is famous for being at the bottom of the ocean,
for not being around anymore. Yeah,
and
exactly.
So season
something
one,
something catastrophic happens.
Yeah, yeah, season one of this show, we see, you know, this beautiful kingdom of men. But knowing that it's based on Atlantis, there's a certain type of fate we can expect. And there's a lot of politics. And that's probably where some of the most rich political intrigue. But even the beginning of the series, the very first episode, Elrond, who is in the Lord of the Rings movies, because elves live forever. So
yes.
There are characters in the show that are in the movies. Elrond is writing a political speech for the High King of the Elves. and someone comes to summon him as he's writing it and makes, you know, a point to note out that he is not an elf lord and he's not invited to the special meeting. So from the very, like, first
it's imbued with that, right? Yeah.
It's like, yeah, sure. You have political machinations, you have political rank, you have these different sure. kingdoms. So you have a kingdom of men on the south part of the map that's pretty, like, they're pretty common peasant type people, and mm-hmm. then you have these high kingdoms of elves, and then you have the high kingdom of men, and they don't always interact.
The dwarves kind of show up every once in a while as well. They've got their own thing going on.
Yep,
yeah, there's a lot. And I think and we can say this with the Peter Jackson films as well. You can say this even with Tolkien's books, of course. Mm-hmm. But everything set in this world is imbued with Tolkien's politics, with Tolkien's concepts of faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of put into this fantasy world to make it digestible, right? Because we want an escape from the everyday world. So if he's mm-hmm. talking about, like, oh, this is what I think is going on in England, and this is what I think needs to happen, people aren't going to pay as much attention as he talks about all of these fantasy characters and stuff. And
yeah.
and you get hints of that in the show as well, just in the first season, right? You see him...
Yeah.
And I do think the creators did a really good job with this. There's certain types of characters that mm-hmm. are historically maligned or seen as just intrinsically evil mm-hmm. throughout the whole universe, the Tolkien universe. And they kind of poke holes in that a little bit. And they say, well, is that right? Is it right to just pass off a whole group as evil because of who they are, right? Ideas of... care for nature, right, and mm-hmm. and a hesitancy to move towards destruction in return for power, right? Mm-hmm. Where does that get us, right? So yeah. all of these things are very present in the show,
yeah.
And I really do think, and watch the show for yourself, whatever you decide about if it's a good show or not. I think certainly the creators did their homework with Tolkien, right? I think
yeah.
they really paid attention yeah. to what he was trying to do and the world that he was creating as well. And it does mm-hmm. feel very set in that world, right? It's very beautiful,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a gorgeous show.
Yeah. And there, so yeah. I have many critiques of it, of ways
sure.
they broke with the lore. And, you know, it's not a perfect show. But I think, as you mentioned, Patrick, I also will mention, so Tolkien, unlike, maybe if you're familiar with C.S. Lewis and, like, Narnia and his works, something that they strongly disagreed on, actually, was the use of allegory. So
yeah.
you're very right in saying, like, Tolkien's values sort of come through his writing.
Yes.
But he is never... was very against making direct allegories. So
he doesn't have a Jesus lion.
No, like, and he was about right? Catholic his whole life.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about that in the main,
yeah.
main segment. But I think, yeah, the part of the show that I really like is there are themes that the showrunners... took out of Tolkien's writings,
mm-hmm.
and no matter where they're going with the show, where some of it is very much not something Tolkien ever wrote about, they're kind of making up their own thing,
mm-hmm.
they're trying to sort of get these themes across. And so the main things that they have said and that a lot of folks have sort of analyzed of the show is one of the big themes is light versus darkness. So
yes.
you see characters
yeah.
that are on the good side, on the bad side, and then you see lots of shades of gray in between.
Yes.
And you see
yeah.
characters sort of looking like they're on the opposite side than you would think they would. And I'm trying to
mm-hmm.
do that without spoilers. You can kind of see it. But
sure.
the light and darkness even is explicitly mentioned. Another huge theme is hope. So
yeah.
the word hope is used many times, but Tolkien actually in Elvish had two different words for hope.
Mm.
And each one means something different. And you see the way those two versions of hope play out in different characters. Some characters... you know, hope in a way of believing that a good outcome will come. And then there's another sort of hope that is a deeper hope that recognizes that the outcome might be bad. And so you see like this kind of nihilistic hope and then a more optimistic hope. And like the show really plays with that.
Yeah.
Another huge theme is the theme of fellowship. And I think that's probably
yeah.
one of the biggest things that you get from Lord of the Rings and from Tolkien's
sure.
writings is
yeah.
like, these different races, the only way that evil is thwarted is when the different races come, you know, sort of collaborate and work
yeah.
together. And you see
Which
friendship
is not easy,
form.
Right?
Yeah,
it's hard. And they all have to make their own sacrifices in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Laying aside self-interest a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And so I love it that there is religious values throughout the show and throughout Tolkien's writings,
mm-hmm.
but they are never overt. And there's... I think much more so than someone like C.S. Lewis, like Tolkien's works are accessible by anyone. If you're atheist, agnostic, Hindu, Muslim, I mean, there are like notable Hindu Tolkien scholars.
Sure.
Who
yeah.
like, and even a major author who wrote a a huge book about J.R.R. Tolkien called Tolkien and the Great War. I was listening to him be interviewed a while ago, and his name is John Garth, and he was saying he's not a person of faith, he's not a Christian, but in his like life's work of understanding the story of J.R.R. Tolkien's life and understanding the things that he wrote about in his, you know, created world of Middle-earth, he feels like he got a sort of backdoor entry into the values of Christianity that meant, like, he feels like he's learned about the values of Christianity and of Catholicism
by virtue of Tolkien, like, and his life and his experience and his writings, right?
Exactly. And I think that's like, in when the show in its best moments, it can sort of do that, like it can share the values of faith and of, you know, a unique political view while never beating you over the head with it. I mean, the show can do that a little bit, but Tolkien's writings never do. And yet the themes of like industrialization versus the natural world. And I will say, I mean, I could talk about the show for 3 hours, so we can wrap up this
and
segment.
We will right now.
And we will. But there is a moment, and this is like a light spoiler, but, and I won't give details, but there's a moment in the third episode where an elf is asked to cut down a tree,
and that's a huge old
massive
like,
beautiful tree
oak tree,
and Tolkien
right. I mean,
Tolkien
gorgeous.
And trees is like a whole thing, man.
Yeah,
but this elf is asked against his will to cut down the tree, and he put in the show he puts his hand on the tree and he says a few words in Elvish before he has to do it. And it wasn't until after I saw the episode I learned later what the elf says in that moment is Quenya, which is one of the elven tongues, languages that Tolkien created. Hmm. And in Quenya, he says a line from the Lord's Prayer. Tolkien translated the Lord's Prayer in Quenya.
Wow.
And he says the words for forgive us our trespasses. And so the show is not perfect. The show, you know,
that's
for
really
someone
striking.
Who
I
maybe.
I know that. I remember that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but, okay, to me, like, people have critiqued the show a lot and say, oh, it's not faithful to Tolkien, blah, blah, blah. And I can agree with some of those points. But for me, that moment in episode 3 is the most Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien thing ever put to screen. An elf saying the Lord's Prayer in Elvish.
To a tree.
To a tree.
Yeah.
That is Tolkien. Like, in, so it's like a elf in Middle Earth speaking a language that Tolkien invented, saying, you know, a very important prayer in Christianity and Catholicism to a tree, a big vestige of the natural world. Like, that snapshot, if you watch all 8 episodes, just for that moment, it's worth it to me. Yeah. Like, it's that moment, it is incredible, and I'm so grateful that we got, instead of getting, like, Netflix trying to do the MCU version of Tolkien's works, which would just could possibly be the worst thing ever created. We got these two nerds who didn't make a perfect show, but they gave it a darn good try.
They
and
did.
I think it's worth consuming, worth checking out. So that is
Rings of Power.
Rings of Power.
How many Rings of Power would you rate this show?
Well,
out of 9.
Oh, okay. Well, so, yeah, because there's actually
there are many more 19, than 9. Yes.
Well, there's 19 main rings of power. We don't have to get that.
Sure.
Out of
sure.
9
the
rings.
9 rings, because we're men, right?
Yeah. I
so
would
far.
Give it a definitely a 7 or like a 7.5.
7.5. Okay. That's pretty respectable. It's a passing grade.
Yeah. So
that's
I great. Say it's worth checking out. You know, this year has been a great year for fantasy television. We
phenomenal.
Got
phenomenal.
Sandman, we got a new Game of Thrones prequel, we got this, we're getting a Willow show, so if you're into fantasy at all, or if you're not, like, get into fantasy, because
this is the
year,
time to get into it, yeah,
there's
plenty of options.
There's no better time to be
wonderful.
A fantasy fan, and I would say no better time to be a Tolkien fan, and we'll talk more about that soon.
Right now.
Hey everyone, before we get into the main segment, just want to make a couple notes. I did this episode without any notes, as sort of a challenge to myself. And that being done, I got a few of the dates wrong, so just want to clarify. Lord of the Rings was published in 1954, in the 50s, not in the 40s, and J.R.R. Tolkien actually died in 1973. So a lot of the dates are pretty close, but a few of them are a little bit off, so just wanted to correct those before getting to the main segment. That's all. Thanks. All right, so if you're this far in the episode and you're not a like Tolkien fan, Middle-earth fan, well, thank you so much for listening. And my goal is today that you can like learn something new. And if you've never read, even never seen Lord of the Rings, hopefully, whether you ever read it or see it, I mean, I would strongly urge you to. Mm-hmm. But my hope is that we can learn some new things about J.R.R. Tolkien, and like, it's actually fascinating stuff, and it collides with a lot of huge political world events.
Yeah, well, and I think to your point, what I value about, one of the many things I value about Tolkien and his writings, is that there's an accessible entry point for anybody, mm-hmm. right? So even like scholars who have devoted their whole career to studying this one specific person and his writings, mm-hmm. We're constantly finding new things being published, right? Yep. By his estate or by his late son.
Yep.
That just add to that. But you also, I mean, you have he wrote The Hobbit, which is largely intended for an audience of children, right? Mm-hmm. He wrote that for his children when they were mm-hmm. kids. You have Lord of the Rings, which is like quintessential fantasy, right? Yeah. Like that is, if you had to distill it into one series, you would probably
created the modern right, fantasy.
Exactly.
Genre.
Yeah. And you have everything in between, and you have things far more academic, and you have things that are far more readable for mm-hmm. for people who aren't as interested mm-hmm. in that. So yeah, I mean, I think, and that is kind of a reflection on his life as well. Like, we're always mm-hmm. finding out these new things about his experiences, because there's so much, right? There's so much that he wrote. There's mm-hmm. so much to talk about with him.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, take it away. I'm excited.
So obviously, so I'm coming from this as a Tolkien super fan. Mm-hmm. I would call myself an amateur Tolkien scholar, because there are actual people with PhDs in this. Like, that's the
sure,
thing about
they get paid for this.
Tolkien versus other authors. Like, you can literally spend your life studying this man's work,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, and it's taught in college classrooms across the world. And I mean, there's lots of other great fantasy authors, but there's none that you can say quite that about them. Mm-hmm. So let's meet the man, the myth, the legend, J.R.R. Tolkien. So in 1892, J.R.R. Tolkien was born. Do you know where Tolkien was born?
I need to let all of you know, Seth doesn't have any notes for this. Like, all of this is just extemporaneous. He knows all of this. Just, there's no notes in front of him. Anyway, do I know where Tolkien was born?
Yeah.
He was born in bloody England, didn't it?
No.
Am I allowed to say bloody?
yes. It's a PG-13.
Incorrect. He was not born in England.
He was not born in England.
Was he born in the U.S.?
He was not born in the United States. He was born in Bloemfontein, South Africa.
Oh, you're kidding. I thought it would take me longer to not know something about him. All right.
Here we go. Fact one. So Tolkien was born in South Africa.
Okay.
To his parents. His parents were British citizens in England. So mm-hmm. yes, you were not far off in saying he, you know, has very strong ties to England.
Sure.
His family is originally German. The name Tolkien is a German name. But yeah, so he was born there. And when he was, I believe, he was about 4 years old, his father passed away.
Oh, okay.
And when that happened, his mom took him and his brother, and they moved back to England. So when he was about, I want to say, 6 years old, so in the very late 1800s, early 1900s, he moved back to England. And so he spent most of his life in England, and he was a professor at Oxford for much of his career.
Later on, not at 6 years old.
Not at 6 years old, but that's like what, you know, his kind of...
Sure,
kind of,
yeah.
So he's very connected to England, but he was not born there. And that comes into his life in different ways later on. But and then when he was, I think, 12 years old, his mother passed away. So at 12 years old, he and his brother became orphans. And
that's
so you don't think of an Oxford professor and linguist and philologist and, you know, the author of the greatest fantasy, books of all time and the inventor of the modern fantasy genre. You don't think of him as someone who grew up as an orphan, but he did. And he actually, when they moved back to England, his mom actually converted to Catholicism and started connecting with Catholicism shortly before she passed
away. So what, were they just like general Anglican, like Church of England Christian, or were they just not really religiously affiliated before that?
Yeah, I don't know exactly. Okay. That's a good question. That's something that, as an amateur scholar, I can't say.
Sure, yeah.
But I don't know that there was strong religion in his sort of upbringing, other than maybe a cultural sort of Anglicanism. But it wasn't until his mother, you know, really started adopting the lifestyle and going to mass and really leaning into Catholic teachings. And not long after she did that, you know, she tragically and suddenly passed away. And so it's really interesting because he didn't grow up, he didn't grow up into Catholicism from the moment he was born, but I think because of his deep connection to his mother and because of her relationship with Catholicism, he remained a Catholic, a devout Catholic, his entire life. And he died when he was 81.
Wow.
In the 70s. But so, you know, it wasn't like it wasn't like he grew up in Catholicism and then just sort of stuck with it. Like, this was a choice, a serious choice he made throughout his entire life. And it's sort of, you know, some people might even say in honoring his mother of, you know, keeping on the faith that she sort of taught to him as she was learning it. And so, yeah, it's just, it's fascinating, interesting. And that is something that characterizes his life. But I think also, as we kind of talked about in the last segment, like, he was not, you know, he was a Catholic. He was not an evangelical. And so, he, you know, he didn't view his fantasy and his works as these sort of things to, like, convert people to his faith. His faith was a very personal thing that he lived out and, you know, in practice in his own way.
Yeah.
But unlike C.S. Lewis, who, you know, used some of his books as an evangelical tool, so to speak, that might be reductive, but that's kind of how he did. That's not really, that wasn't Tolkien's approach. Tolkien was fascinated with language, and language was actually the gateway for him to do many of the things he did in his
life. Yeah, well, we could do a whole episode on his relationship with language, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's... yeah. But I think what's fascinating to me is when he was 5 years old, he started creating his first language that would become a part of his
memory. At age five. Wow.
I believe it was Dwarvish that he started, like, piecing words together. And so yeah, just like the timeline of his life: born in South Africa, becomes an orphan, starts creating his own language. Then he is accepted into Oxford University, and he has to leave Oxford because in, 1914 and 1918, this little thing happened that rocked England and other places of the world called World War I.
Yeah. So, well, and he would have been about the age to participate at that point, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he was. And he stayed in school a little bit longer while a lot of his friends went off to war, but he eventually did end up fighting in World War I.
Wow.
And so he, at the Battle of the Somme, he was a part of that battle, trench warfare, as you've maybe seen in movies or read about in history books. He was in the trenches, literally. We use that phrase. No, he was literally in the trenches fighting Germany on behalf of England and the crown. And he, and this was as a young adult. I mean, I think he was like 19, like very young man.
Yeah.
And in the trenches, this is what I just can't, like, for like literally a decade and a half, if not more, of my life, like, I've been fascinated with this fact. He started writing the first sentences of the book that would be known later and published in the 70s called The Silmarillion. He wrote that on napkins in the trenches of World War I.
That's astounding. Right?
And so you look at the birthplace of the, and there's actually a great film. We should have done that for the movie corner. Oh, well, there's a great film called Tolkien that actually tells this story of the way that he, like, was influenced by. And then the book I mentioned, Tolkien and the Great War.
Was this, I mean, so, like, was this, and use your own assumptions with this, but, like, like, was this a form of escapism for him, do you think? Or was it maybe a little bit of just trying to find some way to, like, express himself in a place that just felt like surrounded by death? I mean, like, what was the, like, how, because I mean, there are so many authors of the early 20th century who participated in that in World War One, a number of whom who died in that, right? And we have their writings, and but I don't know of any of them who wrote, certainly didn't write fantasy during the, like, as shells were falling around them. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, and I think it was, I think you're right in saying it was a form of escapism, and he has actually wrote several things about escapism as being a positive thing. Like, he actually has this wonderful quote that I will butcher, but, like, he basically says, you know, if the world is as dark and painful as many of us experience it to be, we deride escapism as this negative thing, but he's like, we should want to escape and bring people with us, like, to find a respite away from some of the troubles of the world.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. The war for Tolkien was not good. It wasn't a good experience. So he fought in the battle, but he got trench fever, which is something a lot of people... And he got really, really sick and almost died from trench fever. And he actually had to leave leave the military early because he was physically unable to fight.
Wow.
So while his friends stayed, and most of them died, most of his really close friends that he made at Oxford and a little bit before Oxford died in the war, and he was one of the only left, and he had to leave them early because he almost died as it was. And so, I mean... It's like not even fair to compare him to any other, you know, fantasy author. But when you look at like the life of like Brandon Sanderson or J.K. Rowling, great authors, you know, great legacies mm-hmm. that they've built on, you know, the works of Tolkien and beyond. But like
for Sanderson, at least, yeah,
none of them start this way. Like there is no story, no world that was created. And so for Tolkien, language was also the way through which he created his, you know, the word that us nerds use is legendarium. He created this legendarium. So he was fascinated with Old English. He loved Old English texts, and he came across this name, Arendil. E-A-R-A-N-D-E-L. I may have misspelled that, but Arendil. And in The Lord of the Rings and in The Hobbit and all this, Arendil is actually the character Elrond, we already mentioned. Elrond's father is Arendil. And this is actually... But Tolkien... read that name in an Old English poem, and he was fascinated with it, and he stuck with it. And the original idea was Arendil was a great mariner, someone who, you know, operated a ship.
Good with ships.
Good with ships. Much good ship.
You can tell we live in sailing. A mostly landlocked state.
Yeah. But he was this great mariner who became a star.
Wow, like a literal...
Literally like became sky, a star in the night like sky.
Okay.
So that was Tolkien was fascinated with that idea, and that's where sort of the birthplace of his legendarium came from, was a name through a language. And so, you know, he's already writing these languages. He got really sick, but he survived, obviously, World War One, and it was, you know, not a good thing for him, and where he had already experienced so much tragedy of losing both his parents, and then he lost most of his close friends. And that's where, you know, these themes of, like, fellowship, and these bonds that go beyond, you know, beyond a surface level friendship. That's where like a lot of these things are forged for him.
And I'm like continuing on that, like bonds forged through trauma, through like very difficult, dangerous situations, right? Mm-hmm. Like all of that, I can see now reflective of his experience in France, right?
Yeah, and even. They didn't call this World War One because there wasn't a World War Two. This was the Great War.
Yeah, this was the Great War. Yeah, the war to end all wars.
War that, I mean, to oversimplify, like even like Western British and American sort of philosophy and exceptionalism, like with the industrial era sort of kicking off, like America and England thought that this was like the height of history. Like it's only uphill from here, and this Great War is the thing that kind of shook. So many people, it shook the foundations of their belief in humanity. It's like we thought we were beyond.
Well, and you see that reflected in like books written after that. You see that reflected in all the art. This is where like abstract art really starts to explode because people are so disillusioned, right? Why paint the real world if this is what the world is like?
Yep.
Right. And you see increasingly higher numbers of. People who were not religiously affiliated, who would outright call themselves atheists, which would have been almost unheard of, right, at the end of the 1800s, especially in a place like like England. So yeah, I mean, this is just like this is the turning point, right, within almost human history, right. So to live through that and then have to go home,
and so unimaginable, like escapism, right? Makes sense.
Suddenly you're like, oh, maybe he does want to write about a wonderful world where there's these short little creatures who smoke tobacco and eat all day, and and that's the height of living for them, right?
Yeah, of course. Taking a step back, another like just fascinating and beautiful piece of Tolkien's life that I think, I guess for me, I find a lot of joy in people that are maybe familiar with the movies or books, like helping them understand the man behind them is like so illuminating to me. So Tolkien met his wife, Edith, when he was 16 years old and she was 19. And he was in a Catholic boys' home, him and his brother, because he was an orphan.
Sure.
And so he met this woman, and he like almost immediately fell in love. And he like was just enamored with this woman. The priest who operated the boys' home, one of the basically the father figure in his life at that point.
Sure.
For basically said, hey, you're too young, she's too old, you're not in the phase of life to be messing with this.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically forbade him from spending time with her, getting to know her.
Wow, okay.
Separated them for 3 years. And so Tolkien, I mean, he had the option, you know, he probably could have gone around that priest back, but he didn't. He respected the authority of that, you know, priest, and even
the church,
later on in his life didn't. And yeah, a priest as a you know, as a representative of the church, he respected the church's the sort of imperative on him to not. And it wasn't until 3 years later that the time was right, and you know, he wrote a letter to her, and they reconnected and ended up, you know, eventually being married and having several children. But what's fascinating to me is Tolkien, he never did allegory, except kind of maybe once. He had one story, and it's one of the greatest stories of Middle Earth, of the, you know, thousands of years of history he created about this world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called The Story of Beren and Lúthien.
Hmm. Yeah.
So just like summarizing the story, Beren is a mortal man, and Lúthien is a elf. She's actually half, essentially angel, half elf. So she gets to live forever, and men die in Tolkien's world. Elves live, unless they're killed by, like, you know, violence or natural causes, but they, like, they don't get sick, and they can live.
Aging. They don't age.
They don't
right?
age, exactly. Yeah. They're not affected by age, and so they can be immortal. And so in this story, Beren, this kind of rugged, like, he's handsome, but he's, like, very rugged and not easy on the eyes necessarily. He's, like, a man of the woods, you know. Mm. Like Justin Timberlake, you know?
Like Justin Timberlake, you know, that's exactly...
I know that's who you thought of when I said that.
Uh-huh.
He's walking in the woods, and he stumbles upon this elf maiden dancing in a valley in the forest. And this man is enamored with this woman and, like, just can't stop watching her, you know, dance, and is just in love with her. Mm. Immediately falls head over heels. And so he starts to talk to this elf maiden, and they get to know each other, and they have these great conversations. So, like, socially speaking, though, she's an elf princess of a kingdom, and he's just this random dude. Like,
not even an elf.
Yeah, and men don't even live in this same kingdom. But as they start talking, you know, her father, the king, has already picked someone for her to marry, and, you know, he has a plan for her that involves different things. And she eventually, you know, tells him, I love this mortal man. Mm. And the king is like... The king basically says, like, okay, great. He can marry you when he goes and takes the jewel out of the crown of the devil, essentially. So it's the character of Morgoth, and there's these great jewels, the Silmarils. And he literally says, go into hell and pluck off. It's this impossible task.
Wow.
Completely impossible task. And so then there's this beautiful story of Beren and Lúthien helping him, and others. Galadriel's brother. Galadriel is a character in Lord of the Rings.
Nice,
her brother actually helps and actually dies in that quest, which is a big part of the show that we talked about.
Yeah.
The beginning of the show talks about this.
Uh-huh.
And he goes into hell, and with the help of others, not on his own, he plucks. So literally, Lúthien has to dance to distract Morgoth, or the Satan figure, and he plucks the jewel out of the crown, and through a long series of events brings it back to the king and says, all right, I'm ready to marry your daughter. Like,
amazing.
And it's this, and so and then the two actually live life together. But the thing is, the woman, because she's immortal, but when she joins herself with a man, they become married, that then bounds her to mortality. And that's a theme in Tolkien's work, that when, you know, when an elf marries a human, they're choosing a mortal life. And that story is actually also in Lord of the Rings and in the movies, Aragorn and Arwen.
Choosing to love over to live.
To live,
right?
Yeah. And there's a great line in the Lord of the Rings movies where Arwen, who is a descendant of Lúthien and is another parallel, says, you know, to Aragorn, her love, that she would rather... live a mortal life than live all the ages of the earth alone. And so she would rather die and live a human lifespan with a human being,
mm-hmm.
And so, okay, this is all this like crazy lore. What is this? What significance does this have? This story is like a foundational story that, you know, has impacts throughout Lord of the Rings, throughout the entire history of Tolkien's world.
Mm-hmm.
On Tolkien and his wife's gravestones are the names on Tolkien's, Beren, and on Edith's, Luthien.
Oh.
Like, it's let that sink in.
Cry. Yeah.
Tolkien believed so deeply that he married out of his league that he like conceptualized a story where the woman in choosing to be with him sacrificed everything. Like immortality, wow. She gave up to be with this low man. Like that's how he conceptualizes himself in that relationship. It's like she is this angel, literally an angel in the story, who, you know, beautifully dances and is so beautiful and so like alluring, so to speak, that Satan himself is like enamored with her beauty. And like Satan stops his evil for just a moment because he is so enamored by the beauty of this woman. And that's how Tolkien conceptualizes. And it's literally on their gravestones. You can go to them today and see it.
Wow.
And so Tolkien, I mean, like just an incredibly beautiful story, and sort of like tells you the type of man that he was, that the character that represented him, you know, the humility he had and the way that he esteemed his wife for his entire life. Like that's how he viewed and talked about his wife,
yeah.
Which is like really cool.
Wow.
And that's a story that he shared with his children, you know, and that they then got to live out and pass on. And then in Lord of the Rings, the first movie, if you've seen it, there's extended versions. It's only an extended scene. There's a scene where Aragorn, a descendant of Beren, thousands of years later, is singing the song, and the hobbits, the little, you know, short folks who are journeying with him, one of them asks him, who are you singing about? And he's like, well, I'm singing about a woman. And the hobbit asks him, well, what happened to her? And he says, she died. And so Aragorn is both singing the story, the great story of Beren and Luthien, but he's also thinking of his own love, Arwen, who is, if she chooses to be with him,
she will also die. Yeah.
And that's Tolkien's conception of his own love story, of his own marriage. And so just amazing, fascinating stuff. That's, you know, sort of his love life. So he becomes a professor of linguistics at Oxford, is a renowned philologist. He translated
Beowulf, right?
Beowulf.
Yeah.
He's
the reason we have like the modern English.
The Green Knight.
Yeah, Green Knight.
Many huge. Mm-hmm. And that goes to another huge part of his, the reason he did all of this. So, fast forwarding a little bit, the only books about Middle-earth that were published in J.R.R. Tolkien's lifetime are Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. I now own over 30 books
that have his name.
Tolkien wrote about Middle-earth.
Wow.
So, that's 4 books. So, 26. 26 of the 30 books about Middle-earth came out after he died. And that's, to me, that's super important, because you look at another author. Listen, Harry Potter's fine, but look at an author like J.K. Rowling, right? It's clear when you look at how she goes about her career, and I'm using her as an example, plenty of others. It makes sense. She's an author. She writes fantasy to get the check. She writes she writes books.
She writes, buy them. She writes a compelling story, certainly. Yeah. She writes a world that's interesting, that has captured the imagination of millions, sure. But it's so that she can continue to live very, very well-off life.
And she makes millions, and that's like... And then she tried some other things that didn't work, so now she's come back to Harry Potter, like, great.
Now she's making movies, right?
And now, whatever. Yeah. Whatever she's up to, I don't really care.
Yeah.
Tolkien did not see a dime. Like, he did this because he wanted to.
His life's passion, almost. Wow.
And none of it... He didn't publish any of it. Like, he didn't put it out to people, like... Last year, we got a book called The Nature of Middle-earth that's the vast majority of what remains of hasn't been published. Last year. He died in the 70s, and his son died in 2020.
Yeah.
And last year, 2021, we got a new book.
Finally compiling it and releasing it to the public. That's incredible.
To me, like, his motives were so pure. And let me now talk about his motives. So he loved mythology. He was fascinated with, like, Norse mythology. Anything related to King Arthur. But he looked at other European countries, Finland, and you know, other places in Eastern Europe that had these great mythologies that, and Greek mythology, Roman mythology. Mm-hmm. He loved these things and just like couldn't get enough of them, and the languages and the names and the stories and the archetypes and all of that. He loved it. And other than King Arthur, England doesn't have much of mythology. And he didn't. He hated that.
Robin Hood.
He, this country that he, you know, claimed as his own and went to war for, almost died for, this crown that he almost died, you know, sort of fighting to protect against the Germans in World War One. It didn't have this rich mythology explaining how it came to be. And so one of the motives for his reason to create this entire world that most people would never even know about or read about his entire lifetime was because he wanted to create a mythology for England. He wanted England to have a mythology as rich. And so originally in writing about Middle Earth, he was writing about England. It was this world that would eventually turn into England. And actually...
A far-lost, ancient, historical, fictional England, right? Yeah.
Yep.
But interesting.
And you see, when you see his Legendarium, the first, second, and third ages, and Lord of the Rings all happens in the third age, which is what most people are familiar with, it's the story of elves, of all these different races sort of existing, and then slowly passing away and leaving the world to the men. And in the fourth age, when Lord of the Rings ends, it's mostly men that are running the ship. And that's like a development into what would eventually become England. And I won't go super deep into this, but it is worth mentioning, just because he thought of it as a mythology for England does not mean that it was like this sort of nationalist white supremacist idea. So like, and I say that because with the show, there's many actors of color that have been cast, and people are saying, oh, you can't have, you know, a black dwarf woman. Oh, you can't have, you
black
know,
elf.
You know, a Latino elf character because Tolkien made it as a mythology for England. And so it has to have only white people. That's BS. I would love to talk about that point in length later. Feel free to reach out to me. I'd be happy to give you my reasoning. You probably won't, and that's probably fine. But all that to say, yes, it was a mythology for England. The people using it as a reason to be racist, not okay, not cool. So do not hear me say that. But he created a mythology for England. That's why he did all this.
Wow.
And so he created these, you know, fragments of these stories from the First Age and the Second Age. And then fast forward to, he becomes a father, and he has kids of his own. One of them being Christopher, who we've already mentioned, who carry on his literary legacy and published those other 26 books, edited and published. Literally, you know, napkins from the trenches of World War One to random sketches to random things everywhere.
How committed do you have to be? You spend your whole life trying to, like, compile your father's writings, right? Like, and make it make sense and then release it to the world. Not even for your own benefit, right? Just to carry on his legacy, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's...
Yeah,
that's some commitment right there.
It's incredible. Crazy. And yet, once again, the motive for all of this is like love of story, love of sharing story and mythology, love of, you know, carrying on that legacy. Like profit. if Tolkien wanted to make a profit, he should have done things very differently. Profit was not the motive. You know, and I just say that like the J.K. Rowling example. Many authors today, profit is the motive. And that's like, that's how it is. That's how it works. But just so you understand, for this guy, that's not how it worked. And even to go further, so fast forwarding to him having his own kids, as you already mentioned, The Hobbit was the first book related to Middle-earth that was published by J.R.R. Tolkien. And that book you may have heard of, you know, they made three movies a few years ago, have lots of opinions on those, good, bad, and ugly. But The Hobbit originally had nothing to do with this mythology he had created. It was completely separate. And it wasn't even written down. It was a nighttime story he told his children before bed.
This guy going on an adventure, right? And all the little encounters he had along the way. I mean, it's perfect.
And finding
a
magic ring.
You can picture it now. It's a great book to read for bedtime.
His kids would beg him, you know, like to tell
the
next part.
What happens next?
And he had to make it up as he went.
Sure.
And so this, like, this literally genre-creating book that came out in 1936, The Hobbit, like literally there's three movies made, 2012, 13, and 14, within the last 10 years, like millions and millions of dollars grossing major blockbusters, for a book that came out in 1936 that essentially created the genre of modern fantasy. He did all that because he wanted to tell a fun bedtime story to his kids. Like, that's where that came
from. That's crazy. Yeah.
And people had to convince him to publish it. He wasn't going to even publish it.
Yeah, that's
people
not
had to, like,
not why he made
pull
it.
His arm to. And then he sent it to, I don't even remember how many, like dozens of publishers he sent it to, and none of them wanted to publish it.
Wow.
So then he struggled to even get anyone to read this book, because they're like, aren't you a professor at Oxford? Like,
why are you writing a kid's book?
Who is this short Bilbo Baggins dude? Like,
go write a book about linguistics.
Yeah,
right?
What are you doing, dude? Like, you're off your rocker. Like, that was the reaction. People were like, that's no crazy. One's going to buy this. Like, this is kids' stories. No, like, no one cares about this. And that was how he got into all of this. So, you know, if you imagine this sort of great literary statesman who's just churning out these mythological books and getting profit and doing these book deals, like, no, this dude struggled. Like, he was an orphan who fought his way to be able to make it into Oxford and then married the woman of his dreams, who he spent his whole life believing he wasn't even worthy to, like, talk with. And then he had these kids that he adored and loved, and he wanted to tell them a compelling bedtime story.
Yeah.
And that's where all of this huge mythology sort of came out of.
What a wholesome man. Like, what a...
He's so pure and so awesome. Like,
wow.
Like, really. And then, you know, he puts out The Hobbit, and it actually does pretty well, and people start really liking it. And then the publisher's like, this was great. You really need to make us a sequel. And he was like, oh, man. Like, he was like, I don't even know where would you go from here. And then... So he, like, rejected it for a while, and then finally he was, like, he sat down, he's like, okay, I'm gonna write a sequel to The Hobbit. And this man pops off.
A sequel to, like, a 300-page children's book.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Like, if you're an adult, The Hobbit is super readable. You would really enjoy it. You should read it. But it was a book intended for kids. Yes. Adults can absolutely enjoy it. But it was a book intended for kids. And this man is asked for a sequel. And he's like, oh, I don't know. And then he sits down and pops off. So Lord of the Rings is actually, he wanted it to be one volume.
It's one book.
It got split. The publisher split it into three. It's supposed to be one. Yeah. But it's one book made up of six different individual books. So literally they asked him for one sequel and he wrote six. And he took the magic ring that Bilbo finds and created this huge,
global conflict based around
global
this ring.
Global geopolitical conflict that involves race. Like... This guy, like, that's what, hopefully now you're starting to understand.
He fleshed out, what, like, six languages as well? Like,
yeah.
Not just alphabet, but also grammar and, like, spelling.
Phonetics
and,
for, yeah he has fully developed, like, I think two or three fully developed languages, and then, like, huge phrases and syntax in up to, you know, 6 to 12 different languages.
So incredible.
Another, like, just incredible story.
He was like, man, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to.
Oh, my gosh,
like,
he was so committed.
Yeah.
He was so committed. Oh. And there's this another sort of like leaflet, like glimpse into how just this man's brain worked. There's this page in Lord of the Rings, and if you've seen the movies, it happens in the first movie. You know, the Fellowship of the Ring, this, you know, great group of different races on this amazing quest, this amazing journey. They go through the Mines of Moria, which is this abandoned dwarf kingdom, and they go there thinking maybe that there's some dwarves who are there and will receive them, and it's actually been taken over by orcs, and they find this terrible evil fire demon. It goes really bad for them.
Yeah.
The moment that they discover that they're not where they think they are and that they're in deep trouble, they find this book. They find this page of this book called the Book of Marzabal that was written by these dwarves, and it's them writing their last words before they were killed by orcs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're writing, like, we hear the drumming, you know, we can't get out. There's no way out. And it's like this really, like, harrowing moment of, like, oh, crap, we're all about to die.
Yeah,
literally.
We're in trouble. Yeah.
And the book that they find, Tolkien actually created this page. Like, if the pages actually existed, he made it himself in a dwarvish language, the one of the language he's, I believe he was 5 years old when he started creating this language. So he writes out the entire page of text, and then he takes either a candle or a lighter and burns holes into the page so that it would look like the book as the Fellowship found it in that tomb.
That's so cool.
So just imagining this guy writing an entire page worth, multiple pages worth of language that he made up, and he knows what every single word and letter of it means. And then he starts burning holes in it so that it looks more authentic to, like, oh yeah, these people found it in this abandoned mine of dead dwarves.
Wow.
This guy was...
What a man. What
amazing,
a man.
Amazing.
Ugh.
And so he puts out The Lord of the Rings. And, like, a fun other little note, little tidbit that to me is fascinating is The Lord of the Rings came out in the 40s, I believe. I think the first two were published at the same time, the 40s, and then the third one was published a little bit later. But so Hobbit comes out in the 30s, Lord of the Rings comes out in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Lord of the Rings, you know, has this amazing legacy of existing. So in the 1970s, within the hippie movement, right? I mean, that's a whole other
Jumping ahead here, right?
Within the hippie movement, a lot of the hippies really love Lord of the Rings. And there were no movies at this point. Like,
just the books.
Just the books. And the hippies love this story. And actually, if you look at, like, protest art and graffiti in subway stations related to the hippie movement, there was this phrase, these two words that would be put over. Do you know what they are? Have you heard about this?
Maybe. I probably have.
You probably have. But it was this, like, catchphrase in the 70s that was huge. And it's the two words, Frodo lives.
Oh, you're right.
You've heard about that?
Yeah.
So...
Oh, man.
As a political note, it's fascinating because Tolkien died in 76. So, you know, some of this happened as he was about, as he was, you know, nearing his death. And a lot of it happened after he was dead. But the hippie movement latched onto this story because Lord of the Rings, the way they interpret it, Lord of the Rings is the story of this little, you know, simple guy, Frodo, who's given this ring.
An impossible task.
An impossible task. And the wizards of the world, the elves, the high kingly elves of the world, set him on a hell's errand that he's for sure not gonna survive
against an unimaginable world-destroying evil. Yeah,
and you know, the words Frodo lives to them was this inspiration of, like, even when the system and the man is against you and putting you down, Frodo lives. Frodo makes it out alive. And, like, that is, like, this like, statement of chills. Protest,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's great.
So just the way that, like, that's one example of a way that a political movement, like, latched onto his words and was, like, you know, really enthralled by it. You know, another thing that we've already mentioned for Tolkien that was huge is the his love of nature. Mm. Tolkien loved trees. And actually, another fun tidbit, C.S. Lewis, who we've already mentioned a few times, you know, a notable Christian author, both fiction and nonfiction.
Contemporary and friend of Tolkien's as
well.
A
sort of theologian and philosopher of Christianity. Tolkien is the reason C.S. Lewis became a Christian. The main, I mean, there's many
reasons.
Yeah,
I've heard this, yeah.
So they actually went, there was this garden near Oxford that they would walk through with beautiful trees and flowers and everything. And they went on a very long walk, several hours long, in this garden. And Tolkien explaining his faith to C.S. Lewis, explaining, you know, the meaning that he draws from it, and going to Mass and you know, reading prayers in Latin as he could do because he understood Latin.
Of course.
It was in this conversation that was the turning point for C.S. Lewis. And so, like, the book Mere Christianity, The Chronicles of Narnia, like, all of these things, they wouldn't happen if it weren't for J.R.R. Tolkien. So not only did the modern fantasy genre get invented, but even, you know, one of the great fantasy authors, you know, was inspired by Tolkien's works. And that was a thing of faith. And also related to politics, Tolkien has this fun tidbit. I read this the other night. There's a book of like 500 pages long of all of the letters that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote throughout his life. It goes chronologically. He described himself politically as an anarchist. This was in the 40s during World War II. So his son, Christopher Tolkien, fought in World War II.
Yeah.
So the same thing that happened to him, he watched happen to his son. In the Royal Air Force, his son fought. And he wrote him several letters, and we actually have some of those letters. And so he described himself as an anarchist, and he described it as, it's really funny, he was also like a funny guy. He had a very sharp wit. But he said, he's an anarchist not in the sense of a whiskered person who throws bombs. Which is, like, funny because, like, we still picture anarchists today in some ways that way. Like, these, you know, these, like, you know, people.
Crazy unshaved,
you know, people with Molotov cocktails and anarchists. He describes himself as someone who leans towards and prefers, like, local rule and responsibility.
Communal care.
Yeah. And so that was sort of his political, like, caring for the earth caring for us back. And people in a local place having governing authority was sort of his political persuasion for a lot of his life. And, you know, that's a whole other thing that I'm not super qualified to speak on. But, yeah, the politics of J.R.R. Tolkien is fascinating.
Yeah.
And you look at Lord of the Rings and you see those values sort of coming out. And he even said he didn't set out to make an allegory with Lord of the Rings and Middle Earth, but those things just sort of happened. They oozed out of him.
Yeah, they escape because it's... You know, it's
who
integral
he is.
To who he
and
is.
And he's putting
right?
so much of
yeah.
who he is into this world.
And also, and I, like, just running off of that with my mind racing here, like, what you see in The Lord of the Rings, right, is you see these political structures, right, these kingdoms of men, of elves, of dwarves, right, and eventually they all come to ruin, spoiler mm-hmm. alert, for many different reasons.
And that's what the show is mostly going to cover, exactly, every is great how it kingdom all falls apart. Crumbling.
And it's, and like, yes, these catastrophic things happen, but what really happens, what causes it to crumble is inner decay and bureaucracy and mistrust of each other, mm-hmm. right? And turning on one another and backstab. And I can see why that would come out, right? If Tolkien is a man who is saying, look, like, if we're, like the best way to function is to just do away with bureaucracy, right? Mm-hmm. To live communally, mm-hmm. to care for one another as we need it, mm-hmm. right? Like, to be as local and as small as possible in organizing. Of course, he's going to see these large structures. And he's living through the fall of the British Empire here as mm-hmm. well, right? Yeah. Like post-World War I, you get a little of that, especially post-World War II. Mm-hmm. It's crumbling down, right? They're losing their colonies every other day at mm-hmm. this point, right? And there's a whole lot of corruption. There's a whole lot of bureaucracy. There's a whole lot of racism mm-hmm. And othering, right? So I think that's reflected in his books, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not the main point, right? It's not the... He's not doing it as a moral of the story that you take away from it, right? Mm-hmm. But it's just part of the world,
yeah,
right? And that's where you find it. That's where you find these little tidbits. It's just like kind of hidden in the world,
mm-hmm.
Which makes it feel a little more real as well, even as you're reading a fantasy series.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing too. Like Lord of the Rings, I actually heard it recently described as, in some ways, it's actually a post-apocalyptic story.
Yeah.
Because the entirety of Lord of the Rings plays over the backdrop of a world that is destroyed and in
all
ruin.
The kingdoms are gone.
Most almost. Of the major kingdoms.
At that point, yeah.
Actually, I saw like a meme of a lot of the kingdoms in the show that's just come out
mm-hmm.
side by side with how they're shown in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And most of it's like kingdom, ruin. Kingdom, like it just shows
yeah.
you how
yeah.
they sort of walk over the bones of these previous societies.
Hmm.
And that's the backdrop of the Lord of the Rings all sort of happens over that.
Mm.
And you also see in Lord of the Rings like a strong critique of the industrialization, the industrial era. So you have mm-hmm. this evil wizard Saruman who cuts down more and more trees. Cuts down a whole forest to fuel his empire. And then there's this great dramatic irony of that forest actually coming to life and turning on him.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, you see these values of you know, mass consumption. And I mean, Tolkien lived through all these things, but he didn't even see how many of them would come to fruition and that we're experiencing today.
Yeah,
but he was
certainly.
Critiquing them back then.
Yeah.
And he was also, I mean, many people would also describe him as a conservative in the traditional sense of that.
Sure.
He was about Catholic.
Yeah, very Catholic, very connected to old church tradition. Yeah.
Yeah, and was committed to preserving tradition.
Yeah.
And yet, so, you know, he wasn't like some crazy progressive, but like in the way that he talked about the environment and nature and industrialization,
mm-hmm.
he had very progressive values of things that are now sort of maybe more common and popular to talk about and views that
yeah,
are popular
certain,
to have.
Maybe in certain circles.
In certain circles.
Definitely, yeah.
He uh-huh. was like decades and decades and decades
yeah.
beforehand
wow.
already sort of innovating these things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, there's so many... amazing pieces to his stories and to his world.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, in my own life and journey, like I picked up The Hobbit in middle school, sixth
mm-hmm.
or seventh grade. It wasn't mm-hmm. a movie yet. And I hadn't actually like seen Lord of the Rings. So I just read these books and I would watch
yep.
the book and then, or sorry, read the book and then watch,
and then
the,
watch
movie.
The movie. Yeah.
And I just encountered these things. And it's interesting because throughout my life, I mean, I'm still relatively young, but like,
mm-hmm.
I've spent more of my life reading and experiencing these stories than I have not at this point. And as I've changed and grown, I come back to these stories and I find new things in them. You know, it's like this multifaceted
mm-hmm.
world.
Yeah.
And Tolkien created that whole mythology, like a lot of it just to be the backdrop for Lord of the Rings. Like he created these things so then he could destroy them and then be ruins. And then the ruins is what Lord of the Rings is built on. And so, I mean, the fact that most people, like when he passed away, there were 4 books about Middle Earth published that people
mm-hmm.
had access to.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have over 30 and we're still learning things about his world and
yeah.
his languages and all that. And Amazon,
it's incredible.
Jeff Bezos, one of the richest men in the world, CEO of the largest company in the world, stepped down from being the CEO of Amazon so that he could make sure they focused on this Lord of the Rings show because it's a huge deal for them because they spent so much on the rights.
Sure. And, you know, disregarding personal opinion about
Jeff Bezos.
Sure, we could talk crap about Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into that at another point. But, I mean, that's just a sign of, like one of the, if not the single most powerful person in our world today,
mm-hmm.
right, stepping away from the power that he is holding, right? Albeit, like,
being compelled by the stories of Tolkien.
Because of this man, right? Yeah. This man who died decades ago,
mm-hmm.
Who didn't even really care much about publishing his work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a testament to not just the story he wrote, not just to the lessons you get from the stories, but mm-hmm. to the life that he lived, mm-hmm. right? And to the people that he impacted, right? And to the values that he held onto. Yeah, and I'm struck by that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as a sort of concluding point too, Lord of the Rings is one of those things that if you go back to it, you can get a lot of this from the movies as well, but if you read the books, and then if you, like, you know, start to understand some of this history that we've just kind of walked through, the more you learn about it, the more you realize that everything that's come after it is somehow influenced by it.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like, literally, like, look at Star Wars, look at Harry Potter, look at the modern genre of, like, fantasy, even sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that Tolkien is solely responsible for everything, but there is a case to be made, and many greater scholars than I mm-hmm. have made the case that Tolkien, if you have to pick one author from the entire 20th century, that defines it as a century and, like, defines authorship in general.
Yeah,
like,
ever.
It's J.R.R. Tolkien.
Wow.
Author of the century is how some people... There's actually a book called that about him.
Yeah.
Literally, he was the author of the century. And you look at World War I, he's intimately involved with it. It impacts him. World War II, he's intimately involved with it. It deeply impacts him. You know, something like the hippie movement in the mm-hmm. 1970s. Something mm-hmm. like nowadays... The largest company in the world being shifted, you know, catatonically shifted and changed because of some made-up stories that this guy came up with. Because he thought it'd be cool if England had its own mythology. And he wrote a language when he was five. And he wrote down some sentences on a napkin in the trenches of war. Like,
oh, wow. Yeah.
That is J.R.R.
That's
Tolkien.
Amazing. So Seth could continue this for hours and hours and hours, and we might later, but we're going to cut him off now.
Yeah,
for everyone's sake.
Time. Maybe we should start a spinoff. No, just kidding.
We do it all in Elvish.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was Tolkien. Thanks for sticking with us, if anyone did. I'm very impressed if you did.
Thank you.
And we'll be back next week. Yeah,
yep.
Stay tuned.
Yep.
Have a good night or morning or afternoon.
And read Lord of the Rings,
and,
please.
Yeah.
Please. Read Lord of the Rings.